1340s were an incredibly difficult time for England and for London. Actually, that's the biggest understatement I could possibly ever utter. This decade was a nightmare, a horrendous 10 years during which things went from generally bad to considerably worse. And you'd think London would be due to get a break after all it had been through. So far, in the 14th century, they had suffered the virtually 3-decades-long reign of Edward II, and that had turned into a miasma of endless national vicious politics, as a weak king had allowed political factions cause endless rivalries and violence. Edward III had clearly ended that nonsense, but he seemed to be going to war with everyone, and this was crippling an economy that had never really worked in the first place, and this was causing masses of social tension. And if that wasn't enough, London had recently suffered decades of intense political instability, with new deep political factions arising, passionate and rather angry mayoral elections, and the rise of armed gangs of workers wearing liveries, who represented the men and women of London who would work hard, play hard, and settle their differences with knives. It was now dealing with the collapse of its economy for the third time in as many decades, and the king had started one very serious and highly expensive war over in Europe that was completely wrecking everything. Trying to cope with this was becoming a daily case of political whiplash. London's story was about to get very much darker. Hi there, my name is Saul and this is The Story of London, the podcast that tries to tell the history of the city, its people and its politics over many long centuries. We're coming towards the end of book 4 of the story, which I call The Winter Kings, mainly because the last few kings have been somewhat cold and standoffish and brutal towards the city itself. Now, each episode stands alone, but the aim is to make them build towards a grand narrative of London and its people. And in this week's episode, we are required to grasp what was going on outside of London. And we must, I'm afraid, wander away from our narrow alleyways, the busy hawkers and stores on Soper's Lane, the hectic, noisy spectacle of life on Cheapside. In this chapter, we must travel from Scotland to the English Channel to Europe, and more than that, even go back to events going on outside of its time frame. Don't worry, we will end with the Tower of London. But why are we doing this? Well, we need to look at what the king was up to and why it was such a big thing. Because no matter how anybody sees it or words it, this war he was starting was going to last a long time. In fact, here and now, we are just starting the 100th Year's War. And London was going to irrevocably change because of that. So, let's get into it. Welcome to the 120th chapter of The Story of London, Thunderbolt. Okay, let's begin by going straight to the heart of the issue. What started the Hundred Years' War? It's a good question. And there are a series of complex reasons I'm going to get into, but for me, the most obvious reason why Edward III woke up one morning and went, you know, I should be King of France as well as King of England, was due to simply, to paraphrase his own mother's explanation, the King of England had been forced to do homage to the son of a count. A few chapters ago, I mentioned how during her falling out with Edward II, the king's mother, Queen Isabella of England, had returned to France to gather up support to kick out her husband's new favourite, Hugh Despenser, and had taken her son, the future Edward III, with her. And when she was not busy jumping into bed with Roger Mortimer, she had gained the support of her brother, the King of France. But her brother, if you remember, had added a very strict condition on his support. He had wanted her and her son to say they had no claim to the throne of France. And there was a reason for this. But to understand that reason, we need to back up a bit to 1316. Back then, the King of France was King Louis X of the Capet dynasty. By all accounts, one day after an especially vigorous game of tennis, King Louis had downed a large glass of cooled wine and then suddenly got sick and dropped dead. Now, Louis was not just King of France, he was also King of the State of Navarre, and with his death, there was suddenly a bit of an issue. He had only one child, a daughter, but his new queen was pregnant, and so a regency was held until she could give birth. And to the delight of everyone, even though the king died in the summer of 1316, the queen that autumn gave birth to a boy, John I, King of France, born into the role from the moment he came screaming into the world. And he did rule France for about 4 days, and then he died, bless him. Now, France had an issue. The remaining child of Louis X was his daughter, 4-year-old Joan of Navarre. That was not acceptable to the French. So the French picked Louis X's younger brother, Philippe. And so in November 1316, Philippe V became King of France. There was a claim by some that it should have gone to young Joan, but Philippe managed to arrange the French state to agree that under the ancient laws of the nation, the old Frankish law codes or Salic law, women were forbidden to inherit the crown. So that nixed Joan's claim, and Philip was secure with the crown on his head. And Philip was a virile king. He had 4 children. Unfortunately, they were all daughters, which was a bit of an arse. And then he died of dysentery in 1322, which meant his daughters couldn't get the throne. So the title of king jumped to his baby brother, Charles IV. And Charles IV is an interesting chap. In France, they called him Charles the Fair, suggesting a man who is dashing and handsome and good-looking. And in Navarre, they called him Charles the Bald, which suggests something else. But this ties into what we covered a few chapters ago, why Edward II ended up going to war with Charles the Fair. You see, the glib and in no way accurate explanation is that Edward II didn't wish to bend the knee to own his lands in Gascony for like the third time in less than a decade, and so he decided not to. See, the kings of England did own a big chunk of France now, Gascony. And in order to keep ruling it, they had to say, yes, you're the King of France, I bend my knee to you, can I keep running Gascony? And Edward II decided, again, my knees are hurting, I'm not going to bother. And this caused Charles, the handsome but with receding hairline, to go to war with him. And eventually, this was why Edward II sent his wife and his son Edward to bow the knee. And this was when Queen Isabella went to visit her brother and young Edward went to visit his uncle. He asked them to drop all claim to the French throne, as it was getting complicated. And thus, Isabella and young Edward did that, and then went home and had that whole thing to do with Roger Mortimer and Edward II dying in mysterious circumstances. And then, back in France, Charles IV died. Not of baldness, it must be said. And he had no male claimants to the throne. And suddenly, the Capet dynasty had died out. Sure, Charles had a daughter, but there'd been that dodgy law passed a few years earlier, and after much shouting in French, it was decided that his nearest cousin, Philippe, should become King of France and the first of the House of Valois. Now, technically speaking, the House of Capet had not died out, because while the law had banned women from claiming the throne of France, it did not prevent their kids from inheriting their claim. And so, all things being equal, the nearest male relative to the late King Charles was Edward III, King of England. And the French had thought about him becoming king for about 10 seconds. But he was already King of England, and his mother, you know, had probably murdered King Edward II, and, well, no, they would have a Frenchman as their king. And thus, Philippe, son of Charles, the Count of Valois, became king. And this is why King Edward III had been somewhat upset at the idea that in order to rule Gascony, he had to go and bend the knee to this son of a count. Sure, Philippe was the grandson of Philip III of France, but he'd been king ages ago. And here was Edward, son of the Plantagenet line of kings, who could trace their ancestry back to the Capets and beyond to even older, more mythic dynasties. And he had a claim to the throne. But Philip VI was king of the ever-so-powerful nation-state of France, and he had the Pope backing his claim. But it has to be said, of course, he had the Pope backing his claim, as the popes at the time were guests of the French throne in Avignon, as opposed to being based over in Rome. So the popes were always agreeing with the kings of France. Bottom line, King Edward III of England, in all probability, did not like this situation, but he was forced to suck it up. And while King Philip became King of France in 1328, he managed to hold off until 1331, when he finally did homage to him to retain his lands in Gascony. And then again, he withdrew his claim to the French throne. And then King Philip went on to lead the French to a remarkable victory at the Battle of Cassel against Flemish rebels. And this victory made him seem all the more kingly. Apparently, Philip had extorted his men to feats of daring and chivalry, and they'd responded well to his leadership. Philippe followed this up by being determined to win greater glory for France by leading a crusade. Yes, even though the Crusades were over, the idea of the Crusades was still a big thing. Philip of France's name was becoming synonymous with all the virtues which Edward wanted to be associated with. There was Philip being all Arthurian-like. And what was worse is, after Edward's renewal of homage in 1331, Philip had a greater superiority in the chivalric pecking order. Although Philip was much older, he was like about 38 in 1331, Edward saw the new French king as a definite rival in fame as well as power and royalty. I mean, when Philip first expressed his desire to go on crusade, Edward, desperate not to be outdone and suffering from severe FOMO, went, yeah, I'll support that. But it was clear that the great big bloody son of a count in France was annoying the hell out of King Edward III. But that was not the only thing that was annoying him. There was also Scotland. Edward III needed to deal with Scotland. Actually, the place he'd wanted to deal with first was Ireland. Way back in 1210, King John had visited the English conquest in Ireland, but since then, for over 120 years, no English king had ever stepped foot there. The place was chaotic, and the authority of English kings over the Anglo-Norman settled barons had crumbled to being in name only. So during the summer of 1332, plans were made to send a massive invasion force across the Irish Sea to re-establish direct royal rule. And just as these forces were about to sail, the plan got thrown out of the window because fighting started up in Scotland. At a place called Duplin Moor, near Perth in Scotland, armies supporting the new Scottish king, Robert the Bruce's son, David II, who, while still a child, was technically Edward's brother-in-law by marriage to the king's sister Joanna, clashed with rebel forces known as the Disinherited. These Disinherited were mostly made up of Scots who had lost everything they had by backing the English at the Battle of Bannockburn. And they fought under John Balliol's son, Edward Balliol, and they were supported by King Edward III's friend and ally, a man called Henry Beaumont, who was this grizzled veteran of every single major Scottish campaign since before this century started. The tiny army of the Disinherited, which may have only been 1,500 strong, was a tenth of the size of King David II's army, and yet they won a stunning victory, killing numerous Scottish knights and earls, mostly by using longbows. Important point that. Archers had shredded a much larger force. The result was that Balliol was proclaimed king at Scone on the 24th of September, and Scotland sank again into utter carnage. Young King Edward III of England at once abandoned his plans to invade Ireland and turned his attention to the northern border. At a parliament held in York in January 1333, he announced his intention to go north and bring peace, and also make a profit on it. Obviously the latter. Between 1333 and 1337, the capital of England became the city of York, as Edward took the whole machine of government north to let him focus on this war, which meant York grew and London was losing out. The king's massive army combined household troops, feudally summoned nobles who turned up with all their knights, and also foreign mercenaries, which included some Hainaultiers who had last fought alongside Isabella and Mortimer. Regular soldiers were then raised by a system known as array, which was basically a form of press gang, during which conscripted men were paid a day's wage once they set foot outside their home county. And these regular soldiers included hobblers, a form of light cavalry, infantry who fought with spears and knives, and above all, archers who rode on horseback before dismounting to shoot their arrows at people. We have to say here and now, mounted archers would become the most tactically effective and dangerous element of the English medieval armies in the years to come, and the king would raise their status in the army well above the rest of the rank and file. I mean, sure, they were never the equal of the aristocratic cavalry, but mounted archers nevertheless became some of the most respected and feared warriors in Europe during the 14th century. So here was Edward raising this huge-ass army, and then feeding and maintaining them in the field by a system known as the purveyance, which was taken throughout the entire realm. And that sounds awesome, but actually was a cause of endless complaints from his English subjects, as, you know, the food the army consuming was what was supposedly to go into their bellies. Edward III's campaign began in the spring of 1333. Throughout the summer, his captains assisted Edward Balliol in raiding across the border, and then the English laid siege to the town of Berwick before meeting the Scots in the battle at Halidon Hill, 2 miles from Berwick. The tactics used at Halidon Hill were those developed by old Henry Beaumont back at the Battle of Dupin Moor. And here, King Edward learned the tactics that would serve him well during the years ahead. Although his army was perhaps only half the size of the Scots, Edward took up a strong defensive position on a hill, with 3 divisions of dismounted men-at-arms, each flanked by divisions of dismounted archers. The king commanded the central division, Edward Balliol the left-hand one, and the Earl of Norfolk, the king's uncle, was on charge of the right, alongside the king's younger brother John of Eltham, the Earl of Cornwall. There would be no cavalry charges at the Scottish line this time. The Battle of Bannockburn had taught the English that riding your horse at lines of well-defended infantry with very large spikes was basically suicide by Scotsmen. So the English sat their asses still and waited. Now, when the massed bands of Scottish spearmen advanced up the hill, the English bowmen loosened a vicious rain of arrows upon them, causing panic, terror, and death, and scattering much of the Scottish advance before it even reached the men-at-arms. By the time hand-to-hand combat was joined, the Scots were already tired and terrified. King Edward and his men attacked the enemy bravely, and the king fought hand-to-hand, apparently, against Robert Stuart, the 17-year-old Steward of Scotland. The battle very swiftly became a rout. And at that point, Edward and Balliol's men now got back on their horses and chased the shattered Scots down. By the time the whole thing was done, Scottish losses were officially horrendous. Edward's victory at Halidon Hill was so complete, he was able to put Edward Balliol fully on the throne, reclaim Berwick for the English, and lay claim to the huge tracts of territory in the Scottish lowlands. All convinced it won, King Edward had spent the second half of 1333 back in the southeast of England, hunting and, you know, holding tournaments. It all seems so incredibly, indecently easy. But of course it wasn't. You got to understand, by 1334, King Edward had a lot going for him. He was a proven leader. He was clearly favoured by God. He was a dazzling king of a magnificent, if somewhat expensive, court. His family was fine and growing. His marriage was a great one. And to cap it all off, he had 2 things which most men who achieved these targets never really had. He had his health and he was young. But he was, in terms of conquering and dealing with the Scots, also being incredibly short-sighted. In his determination to confront the Scottish army, he had concentrated wholly and exclusively on having big set-piece battles. One big punch type affairs. I mean, that was his idiom. All cool king gloriously leading his men. And he was great at stuff like that. But he had ignored the wider aspects of subduing a country. Edward had basically won that battle and expected that the Scots would just kind of, you know, surrender. However, as much as he thought it was all over, it wasn't. The forces now designated the rebels returned with a vengeance, and Edward had to launch a newer, even more costly campaign. No one can doubt his resolution in organising this new Scottish campaign. Troops were assembled at very short notice at Newcastle. Monthly loans were secured from the Italian bankers, the Bardi. Clerics and laymen were induced to give personal loans to the king. New means of taxation were devised. Old forms of taxation were revamped. The whole state went on a war footing again. And by the end of December 1344, the army had gathered, banners bearing royal arms and the arms of St. George and St. Edmund had been ordered, and Edward was dressed in new armour and surrounded by a bodyguard of 200 mounted archers picked from the best men of Cheshire. And the result of this, again, failure. There was to be no glorious set-piece battle to be had. The Scots had learnt the hard way. Don't fight him in a straight fight. Edward was having to learn some hard truths about war. The battles he had yearned to fight as a teenager were turning out to be long, drawn-out campaigns. Strategies of supply mattered just as much as battlefield heroics. Leadership actually involved way more careful diplomacy than just military glory. And if that wasn't frustrating enough for the young king, then the French got involved. You see, since 1326, Scotland had been in alliance with France, and by June 1334, when Edward Balliol was bending the knee to Edward III, it was known that King Philip VI of France had snatched the deposed King David II and his wife Joanna from Scotland and had given them sanctuary in Normandy. In David's absence, Scottish resistance had rallied. Much of the winter of 1344 and the summer of 1335, King Edward III had spent marching around the lowlands of Scotland in a kind of destructive, violent tour of terror. And it all came to a head in August 1335. The French declared that France would support the Scots with 6,000 troops, including 1,000 men-at-arms on horseback. And they sent King Edward III a memo saying this. Well, it was a formal messenger to inform the English king of the French king's decision, but I'll call it a memo. And the French king then sent a second memo, which suggested that the English king should now give up all this fighting malarkey and submit his quarrel with young David II to the arbitration of King Philippe of France and the Pope, mainly because Edward's quarrel was messing with his whole let's go on a crusade idea. And as well as this, a third memo was sent to Edward III about a bunch of Frenchmen in his court, and men like Robert of Namur and his uncle, Robert d'Artois. Robert d'Artois was a cousin of Edward and an enemy of Philip VI. This third memo basically was the French king saying things that meant the king and Artois could never be able to hug this out. Now, all these formal messages and men were closing in on Edward during the course of that August, and they were really what were going to cause the drawing up of the battle lines of the opening part of the first Great War of European Nations, the Hundred Years' War, as it came to be known in the 19th century. On the 7th of August, Edward was up in Perth. The French memos had still not reached him, but his messengers had brought news that the French were gathering ships in the Channel ports. Rumours abounded of Philip's plan to aid the Scots had also reached him. And King Edward took one look south and realised that England was incredibly vulnerable. It was stripped of all of his best fighting men. They were up there with him. And any sizeable French invasion could cause havoc. By the 12th of August, he designated men to represent him at a council in London and appointed others to array and lead the Londoners if the realm should be invaded. And we mentioned some of the preparations for that last episode. And on the 18th of August, the seriousness of which England regarded the threat of invasion was shown by the king giving an order to move his eldest son to the safety of Nottingham Castle. The rumour in the north was that King Philip of France had requisitioned 715 vessels in alliance with the King of Bohemia, and he was going to invade by force. While this was not strictly true, Edward panicked and divided his kingdom into three for defence and depth. Ships were requisitioned to defend the coasts. Beacon fires were to be assembled. England and Wales were poised to expect the French armada to be launched by Philip of France in the name of David II of Scotland. Philip of France, however, was making a mistake. Philip had nothing to gain from all this posturing. Even if he'd been successful and had forced Edward to acknowledge the right of David II to rule, Edward would merely have turned his attention elsewhere, perhaps to attack France. And this is why, although King Philip never said so openly, the Pope was quietly whispering in his ear things like, "Will you just let it slide, will you?" and to give up the Scottish cause. Indeed, King Philip's sole achievement in sending a few dozen ships to raid the English coast was to shock the richest and hitherto most secure towns in the kingdom into the realisation that they were vulnerable to attack from France. When the good people of Southampton and Portsmouth found themselves set upon and their houses burnt to the ground, the whole of the south of England realised how important this war was going to be, and Edward's ability to raise cash for a foreign war was suddenly increased. August 1335 was a point of no return in the developing struggle between Edward and Philip. When Philip's letter of support for the Scots finally arrived, Edward replied that his pacification of Scotland would be over quickly and would not impede Philip's plans for his naffing crusade. He also added that Philip had no right to get involved, as this was purely a domestic matter between him and his subjects. Quietly, the Pope was telling the same thing to Philip. Even more important, however, was the English captured the garrison of Roxburgh, and the Earl of Moray surrendered, and quickly most of the other Scots leaders saw they had little to gain and much to lose, and they gave themselves up. Basically, Edward was winning and had won, and he'd won simply by refusing to declare peace in Scotland. It was a continual low-level war punctuated by occasional expensive large-scale expeditions. This allowed him to keep the pressure on the Scots and eventually to wear them down. The war, he was reminding the Scots, the French and the Pope, would go on. And unless a permanent peace could be arranged and won on his terms, he'd just raise another army the following year and yet another the following. Finally, in late 1335, Philip of France and the Pope were particularly eager to see a permanent settlement come about. Philip had been told in no uncertain terms by the Pope that his bloody crusade idea was dependent on there being peace in Europe, no compromises accepted, and that especially meant between England and France. Accordingly, both Philip and the Pope sent negotiators to see Edward. Edward was in no rush to come to any agreement, and it was only in January 1336 before any measure of acceptable compromise was agreed upon. It was decided that Edward Balliol would rule Scotland for the duration of his life and that David II would be his heir. Everyone agreed on this, except David II. He said no. I mean, the kid's only about 12, 13 years old. Did he even have an opinion? But the word came in that he said no and Edward went ballistic. And he had reason to. You see, for Edward, the king was simply too young to make such a decision by himself. Therefore, someone else had made the decision for the young king. Who? Well, it could have been some of those bloody Scottish rebels still holding out for another round of fighting against the English king, or it may well have been King Philip of France, secretly persuading David's guardians they could only lose by this deal. Whoever was behind it, this no set Edward on the path of outright war, and made the Pope cancel his bloody crusade. But that cancelling of the crusade changed the situation, because Edward knew now that when Philip got over his disappointment of not going off to the Holy Land, it would leave him with all his men and all the ships he'd gathered and all his weapons sharpened for a war with no obvious enemy except the man who had basically spoilt his dream of reconquering the Holy Land. On the 3rd of April 1336, Edward had dinner on a ship called the Christopher, which was moored in the Thames near the Tower of London, and he had to plan out for the next stage of what was inevitably a growing war. His first decision was to get to Scotland really fast. The French were now committed to landing troops in Scotland. However, landing armies needed landing places where they could enjoy safety and find supplies. Edward had thus had plans to destroy any possible form of nourishment within reach of any suitable landing places on the east coast of Scotland. So, Edward travelled up to the east coast of Scotland and utterly wrecked it. I mean, abbeys were emptied of all their food, every single cow or cattle or any kind of wildlife was just killed. They burned the cornfields. Whole towns were destroyed. Edward personally oversaw the destruction of Aberdeen. Against the fury of an English army in full destructive flows, the Scots could do nothing. Envoys were sent by France to try and prevent the war from escalating, but nothing worked, and so they went along with it. The French fleet, amassed by Philip to originally fight the infidel, was now sailing around the southern English ports, attacking any English ships they found. Edward wrote to his admirals on the 18th of August, urging them to intercept the enemy, but it made little difference. Englishmen in Ghent and Bruges began to be rounded up on the orders of the Count of Flanders, Philip's ally. And then at the height of this extreme panic, Edward received terrible news. John of Eltham, his only brother, died suddenly. John was just 20 years old, and Edward had been fond of him and made him the Earl of Cornwall. Edward was exceedingly upset by this. He ordered 900 masses to be said for John's soul. The day after Prince John was lowered into the stone floor of Westminster Abbey, Queen Philippa gave birth to a second son, William of Hatheld, but the child was sickly and was dead within weeks. Edward was disturbed by this and decided that his dead baby should not be buried in the family mausoleum at Westminster, but buried all the way up north in Yorkminster. God seemed to be turning against Edward. He'd lost a brother and now a son, and then the French had attacked Portsmouth and Jersey. And at the same time in Scotland, the rebels had won a series of victories against under-resourced English garrisons up there. It was as if Edward had never fought and won at Halidon Hill. His achievements were being undone. The winter had set in very cold, and rumours were spreading across the land. It was said that a calf was born with 2 heads and 8 feet. A very bright comet was seen, quote, which darted forth its rays with terrible streams, unquote, and was seen as a precursor of devastation. If Edward was a warrior of God, then God was giving him a sign. He needed to act boldly. When Parliament met in 1337, he responded by doing something bold. Radical legislation was introduced into the country. A reform of the wool trade was planned. War was looming on 2 fronts. And as well as this, he went on to create a whole bunch of new nobles, new earls of England. Edward III had been king for a decade at this point. For 7 of those years, he'd ruled in his own right. And in his early years, the young man had shown himself to be a willing friend of the aristocracy. The great tournaments he'd held had grown familiar with the wealthy fighting elite of the country. Now, there had been a general decline in the state of the aristocracy during the previous 2 generations. Edward I had been distrustful of the nobles in general and correspondingly stingy with giving out earldoms. Edward II had been more inventive and had given out quite a few earldoms, but he tended to save his big awards as gift for his immediate favourites and didn't want to create families of great men, because he feared they would rival his authority. Unlike his father or grandfather, Edward III saw a greater truth to being an English king. And that was that there was a natural community, not conflict, of interest between a king and his great subjects. At the March 1337 Parliament, Edward laid out this philosophy in clear terms. He told the assembled lords that, quote, among the marks of royalty we consider it to be chief that, through a due distribution of positions, dignitaries and offices, it is buttressed by wise counsels and fortified by mighty powers, unquote. A magnificent feast was held to celebrate the new creations, costing hundreds of pounds, and 20 knights were also created. But this unprecedented creation of landed magnates was no fit of idle generosity on Edward's part. Rather, the situation in 1337 demanded it. The king needed military supporters with resources and mighty households, and an obligation to the crown to fight. Not only was Scotland perpetually in turbulent war, war with France was really stepping up. The Plantagenet world was on the brink of a war that would last not merely for months and years, but for generations. And it was foresight that he decided to create a bunch of aristocrats who would support them, not for years or months, but for generations. The Hundred Years' War had basically begun. And yet for the next 3 years or so, we could well describe it as a phony war, as both sides manoeuvred for allies and positions. Edward had concentrated his war efforts on the Low Countries, where it paid for the Count of Hainault, the Duke of Brabant and other allies tens of thousands of pounds in bribes to form a grand alliance against the French king. This was the conventional but expensive tactic that English kings used, and he also bolstered this by purchasing the title of Imperial Vicar General from the Holy Roman Emperor Ludwig IV of Germany. That title gave him full imperial rights over the lords of the Low Countries. This expensive diplomacy had only been interrupted briefly by some fighting in the autumn of 1339, when Edward had brought an army to northern France to fight a vicious campaign in the border territories around Cambrai. And Philip, meanwhile, had sent troops deep into Gascony, advancing as far as Bordeaux. But these were just preliminary skirmishes. The war escalated, and Edward III now made his formal claim for the crown of France. Back in October 1337, he began styling himself King of France and England in letters. But 3 years later, he made his claim explicit and public in a huge ceremony. On the 26th of August 1340, Edward III entered the Flemish city of Ghent, with his entire household accompanying him, including his heavily pregnant queen, who was carrying the couple's sixth child in 10 years. The boy who would be born during that royal visit on the 6th of March was John of Gaunt, his name being derived from the English pronunciation of Ghent. Anyway, back in January, a huge ceremony had been prepared for the king's arrival, and the large open space of the Friday Market was being lavishly decorated in expectation of a mammoth crowd. A platform was set in the middle of the square, and all around it hang banners displaying Edward's royal coat of arms, the symbol that adorned almost everything that was given the royal mark of approval. But these were not the coat of arms with which people would have been familiar. For 142 years since the penultimate year of Richard the Lionheart's reign, Plantagenet kings had depicted their English sovereignty through the symbol of three lions passant gardant, commonly known in heraldry as leopards, against a bright red field. The three lions. Now, there was something radically different about the royal arms there in Ghent. Rather than striding proudly against a whole coat of arms, the leopards had been quartered with the ancient arms of the French crown, golden fleur-de-lis against the blue field. Moreover, the French fleur-de-lis took pride of place, displayed in the upper left and lower right-hand corners of the coat of arms. It was a stunning alteration to a generations-old heraldic device, and it left no doubt the message Edward was about to deliver to the crowd that assembled in the market square. Edward walked out onto the stage and stood before the crowd, flanked by the great men of his court and the magistrates of the three most important towns of Flanders. Raising his voice to a shout, he called on the townspeople of Ghent to recognise him as the king not only of England, but also of France. He demanded their obedience and took homage from the various Flemings, including Guy of Flanders, half-brother of the count. Edward reassured all those before him that he would respect their liberties and protect their mercantile rights. And then he decided to celebrate it all by holding a jousting competition. This event, held in the packed marketplace of Ghent, marked the most profound change to the Plantagenet crown since, well, I don't know, Edward I had gone on crusade. Edward III's formal assumption of the royal titles and styling himself King of France fundamentally changed the relationship between the two kingdoms in a way that could not be returned back. This was not just a war between a king and a rebellious vassal, or two egotistical kings clashing over who was the most glorious. This was now a formal war of succession. And it started very badly for the English. For the first 3 months or so, little happened. But then his newly made earls and friends, the Earls of Salisbury and Suffolk, had been captured during fighting outside the town of Lille. Then Flanders was overrun by the French. And then Queen Philippa was a hostage in Ghent. As time went on, things got worse. The channel was patrolled by French ships that threatened to ruin the English wool trade, and for 2 years the south coast of England had been plagued by French pirates, who reduced the town of Southampton to little more than a smouldering ruin. Edward needed to bring the war to the French, and he'd been planning a large military invasion for some months. Inevitably, word of the preparations of this force to invade France reached Philip VI, and a huge French fleet, detailed to blockade the ports and to prevent the English army from landing, had been gathered from the coasts of Normandy and Picardy. Edward was therefore forced to cross the Channel and put his army ashore in Flanders. It was a desperate military action dictated by extreme circumstances. He was losing. King Philippe was always one step ahead of him, it seemed. And now as Edward looked towards the coast, he saw that the French had ordered in a tight position their vessels to be anchored and chained together in three lines across the mouth of the River Zwin. Up the coast from Ostend and near Bruges, the River Zwin was the ideal place for Edward III to land his army. He knew it, and the French knew it, and Edward could not really deviate from his plan as his budget could not afford it. However, Philippe was again one step ahead of him, as Edward personally led a force of no more than maybe 150 ships. Before him were about 213 French and Genoese ships, Philippe VI's great army of the sea. Edward was in personal command of his little flotilla, and after a night spent anchored within sight of the French fleet, with their armoured prows, Edward directed his ships to approach the mouth of the River Zwin at about 3 p.m. They came up from the southeast, with the sun and the wind behind them. As he moved into view, Edward must have felt, I imagine, a pang of anxiety, perhaps even fear. He was about to fight one of the largest naval forces ever assembled in the English Channel, and if he lost, his entire campaign would be utterly ruined. A medieval sea battle was much like a medieval land battle. There was little manoeuvre or pursuit. When two navies came together, it was a collision followed by boarding and then desperate, vicious fights at close quarters, using much the same tactics as those used on the battlefield. Only this time, they were fighting on the wooden decks of ships. And although there were some large weapons carried on board these ships to hurl stones or giant crossbow bolts at the enemy, by and large it was the bolts and arrows and the violent smash of men-at-arms, maces and clubs that did all the damage. And the result of the English sailing at the French? Well, to quote the contemporary writer at the time, Geoffrey Barker, quote, "This great battle was so fearful that he would have been a fool who dared to watch it even from a distance," unquote. The French, however, had made one mistake. The decision to shackle their ships together in three ranks across the mouth of the River Zwin. This gave them fixed positions the English had to fight through, but it sacrificed all mobility for what seemed and was not the security of closely ranked ships. The two rows of vessels behind the front line were unable to move forward to help their comrades as the English fell upon them. Their greater numbers meant nothing now. Battle was given at close quarters and by deadly means. The air was filled with the blast of trumpets, the throb of drums, the whoosh of arrows and the splintering sounds of huge ships smashing into each other. The English fleet attacked the French when in waves. Each ship rammed into an enemy vessel, attaching herself with hooks and grappling irons as English archers and French crossbowmen traded hailstorms of vicious arrows and bolts. The bowmen took up high vantage points, either on the raised end castles of their ships or on the masts. When they'd killed enough of the defenders, men-at-arms clambered aboard the enemy ship to, well, lash out with death and destruction at close quarters. The French were trapped and slaughtered. It was a murderous battle. Between 16,000 and 18,000 French and Genoese sailors were killed, either cut down on deck or drowned. Both the French commanders died. One was killed as the ship was boarded. The other was captured and hung from the mast of his ship. It was one of the great early naval victories of English history, the Battle of Sluys. As dusk approached on the evening of the 24th of June 1340, 6 months after he declared himself king of the best part of Western Europe, Edward stood aboard his flagship, a cog called the Thomas, and watched the sea offshore from Sluys in Flanders churn with the blood of tens of thousands of Frenchmen. He was wounded in the leg, but it was an injury that was worse than the pain. The English had murderously and brilliantly won. The English sailors and their Flemish allies cheered and celebrated the victory in disbelief. Almost the entire French fleet had been captured and destroyed, eliminating at a stroke the danger to English merchant ships in the Channel. And Philip's ability to blockade the English from the continental coastline was gone. The death toll alone on the French side was shocking. Thus, the Battle of Sluys became one of the great moments of English naval history. But at the time, it was the only victory amidst a tide of overwhelmingly bad news. After 3 years of fighting, Edward's war with France had put a greater strain on English government and royal finance than any military project since the Third Crusade. Sluys was a great victory, no doubt, but it came at a staggering cost. Edward's war was conceived on the grandest possible scale, way beyond the means of even a Plantagenet king who expected to incur massive debts in the course of his wars. One chronicle estimated that Edward's payments to his Flemish and German allies around the year 1340 was up to 2,000 marks of silver a day. We're fairly sure that was an exaggeration, but it wasn't a wild one. Even as he stood on the cog, the Thomas, and watched French ships burn in 1340, Edward had already spent £400,000 on this war. Much of it was owed as debts to Italian banks, mostly the Bardi and Peruzzi of Florence, but he also had substantial accounts with the Porterani of Florence and the Burgersdrani of Lucca, as well as with banks and merchants in the German Hanse and in the Low Countries. At home, the northern merchant, William de Pole, organised even greater loans from syndicates of merchants from London and York, who advanced hundreds of thousands of pounds to the crown. Although usury was still forbidden, Christian banks and merchants employed a wide variety of ingenious fees, learned from the Corazins of the previous generations, to hide the fact that interest on loans ran as high as 40%. Royal crowns and jewels stood as collateral against the loans, as did vast amounts of silver plate, which was volunteered for the war effort from English religious houses. The staggering debts Edward had run throughout Europe were already beginning to cause him awkward moments. Exactly a month after the French fleet was destroyed, the Earls of Northampton, Warwick and Derby were arrested in Brussels by the King's creditors. They had stood guarantees of debts that were in default, and it was only with some difficulty that Edward managed to get them released. Back at home, England was suffering for Edward's new war. The effects were felt at every level of society. Taxation was levied heavily, efforts were made to rig the wool market, mostly by creating monopoly on the trade to the leading and giving it to the leading merchants, and money was running desperately short. Sluys had been a great victory, but what followed was frustration and costly stalemate, as Philip VI decided to sidestep all attempts to draw him into a battle. I mean, Edward at one point offered the French king the prospect of a personal duel or a stage battle between 100 knights on either side. But we should not be surprised when the rather podgy French king approaching his 50th birthday decided he did not want to take up the offer of the virile 28-year-old Plantagenet. This refusal Edward took as a personal affront. But the two military operations that followed the offer had also been failures. Attacks on the border towns of Tournai and Saint-Omer cost a great deal more money and manpower, but led in both cases to nothing but slaughter and retreat. Edward started deploying chevanchies, which was a name for an armed horseback charge through the countryside designed solely to cause terror and chaos amongst the local people. These felt great to be on, but yielded no strategic advances. With the signing of the Truce of Espletien, which established peace everywhere from Scotland to Gascony and concluded a season of pointless campaigning, the English war effort seemed to be mired in stalemate. The king decided he needed to go home, in frustration, to cross the Channel in November 1340, and with winter approaching, it was more dangerous than usual to actually attempt it. But the king was desperate and furious, and ready to scream at everyone and anyone over his financial situation. In spite of that one great victory, the war with France was floundering. Edward III was desperately short of money, desperately short of glory, and increasingly short of allies. And rather than blame himself, Edward was convinced the problem lay back in England, and with the Regency administration he'd left behind in Westminster, which was led by the Archbishop of Canterbury, John Stratford. The king was not only convinced that he was being deliberately starved of funds he needed to fight the war, With the stress of his position laying heavily on his mind, he'd begun to imagine he was being hung out for the slaughter. He even wrote to the Pope, saying, quote, "I believe that the Archbishop with me by lack of money to be betrayed and killed," unquote. And so this is why he decided to sail back to Westminster and start cracking down on backsliders through a storm. After a brutal crossing, his boat reached London long after curfew had been declared on the 30th of November 1340. His ship had managed to make it across the vicious seas in the Channel and the turbulent waters of the Thames estuary, which had not been much better. So you can imagine Edward was probably soaked to the skin, probably seasick, and not in the best of moves when he arrived. Around midnight, his captain put into the wharf by the Tower of London. The rather drenched and grim-faced passengers disembarked, and as they looked up, tired, cold, wet, it was as if the whole tower was asleep. There was no sound and no movement on the ramparts. The king's return, after all, was not expected. Although there should have been a close watch kept on the fortress after dark, no one saw him arrive. That London's premier fortress stood apparently unguarded during wartime made Edward III blow a gasket. He burst into the tower, inspected it in fury, and began to make a list of men he wished to be brought before him. His royal treasurer, his chancellor, and all their department officials, his justices, the mayor of London, and the London merchants were supposed to be managing the wool trade. And of course, the constable of the Tower of London, upon whose watch the capital's key stronghold had been left so disgracefully unguarded. Edward's anger is easy to understand. The war he had invested so much money into after 3 years of sporadic fighting had merely left him entirely bankrupt. Edward was in huge arrears to his Flemish allies and could not fight until they'd been paid the enormous sums they'd been promised for their support. For this, he needed his ministers to extract every single penny from the realm. And therefore, the next morning on the 1st of December 1340, the morning after his first explosion in the power, Edward embarked on a whole-scale purge of his government. He began to dismiss his officials from the top and worked his way down, first to go with the Chancellor and the Treasurer. Then he had the Chief Justice of the Common Pleas, one of the two most senior judges in England, arrested, along with four other judges, the Constable of the Tower, and several leading English merchants. A number of Exchequer officials were fired, and instructions were issued to clerks who remained to provide a full audit of their recent transactions. Further, to demonstrate his utter lack of faith in the Exchequer, Edward arranged for tax receipts to now be paid into an emergency treasury here in the Tower of London. Edward was about to try and purge his entire government, right in the middle of a big war. And how the hell was London going to cope with this? Well, I'll cover that next chapter. Thanks for listening. Terribly sorry we didn't get back to London till the end. There was an awful lot going on there, but that gives you the context of what's happening. Next chapter, what was London doing? All right, thanks for listening. Bye.